Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. The website is talkinganimals.net. My guest today is Scott Blaze, CEO of the newly formed Global Sanctuary for Elephants, a collective of elephant experts dedicated to the development and support of elephant sanctuaries internationally. Blaze has more than two decades of experience working with elephants, including being a co-founder of the 2,700-acre elephant sanctuary in Tennessee. We'll discuss elephants, particularly captive elephants, and how to improve their lives with Scott Blaze presently. Later in today's show, we'll have a brief chat with Gene Duby of the Sarasota Audubon about their forthcoming Celery Fields Birdathon, a nifty educational morning for students taking place November 9th. We'll get to all this in a moment. First, I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge Lou Reed's passing. True, this isn't a music show, but we do play lots of music on Talking Animals and periodically feature musicians as guests. Besides, Lou Reed was a legendary and enormously influential artist, one of rock's all-time greats. He was also famously a major league grump who didn't suffer journalists gladly. An additional reason to salute him on Talking Animals is that the show yielded an accidental encounter with Lou Reed. About 3 years ago, I was set to interview Laurie Anderson, the amazing composer and musician who's been married to Reed since 2008, at the appointed hour from this very studio. I called the number I'd been given to reach her, and after a couple rings, I heard, "Hello?" I kind of gulped, quickly realized it was Lou Reed. I hoped he didn't hang up. It was live radio after all, as this is. And I explained as politely as possible why I was calling. There was a beat, then another beat. Like sort of taking it all in and pondering then, "Laurie!" She came on the line. We had a lovely conversation. But I'll never forget that brush with Lou. Rest in peace, Lou Reed, and my deepest condolences to Laurie Anderson. All right, let's get to our conversation now with Scott, with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Scott Blaze back to Talking Animals. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Duncan. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you. I really appreciate being here.
Well, yeah, and of course I say welcome back in that you were part of a panel discussion about circus elephants we did back in January tied to Ringling's engagement being in town then, and that discussion was a little on the chaotic, even maybe contentious sides, in no small measure because I had sort of made a point of inviting a Ringling corporate spokesman to be part of that panel and made for some spirited exchanges. So today it's just you, thankfully perhaps, and what promises to be a much calmer conversation. So, of course, I want to explore the Global Sanctuary for Elephants, and we will in a few minutes, but I think to sort of create a little bit of context for that, maybe walk us through some of the key moments of your elephant life over the last sort of two plus decades. For example, how did you first get started working with elephants?
Yeah, this is actually a pretty involved story, but I'll try to do a brief synopsis for you.
Sure.
I was very fortunate enough to pick up a summertime job when I was living in Canada with my parents. As a 13-year-old, started cutting grass and picking up garbage at a safari park, and became intrigued with the elephants, and fortunately was able to acquire a job in the elephant department when I was 15 and started working with elephants shortly thereafter. And basically it's kind of a hook, line, and sinker. You know, once you're exposed to elephants, I think there are a few other things in the world that compare.
Yeah.
While working there, again, gained phenomenal experience, learned a lot of really beneficial things, and also, you know, was exposed to some issues that I felt we needed to change. If this is the way elephants needed to be kept, we needed to do something different. They needed more liberty, they needed autonomy, they needed more space, and they essentially needed to have their life. And that's what we set out to do. I joined Carol Buckley, and we started the Elephant Sanctuary in Tennessee in 1995, and started off with a dream of hoping to help, you know, maybe four elephants, maybe 10, and that quickly snowballed. We grew from 100 acres up to 2,700 acres and took 24 elephants in at the Elephant Sanctuary and just saw just how substantial a difference a sanctuary can provide to an elephant's life.
Wow. Well, you've covered a lot of ground in, you know, 20-some-odd years and one sort of mouthful there. So that's great. And I definitely want to touch a little bit more on the elephant sanctuary. But one thing, just to sort of back up that I think was sort of really important that you said sort of early on in your answer was, you know, that once you'd sort of gotten started working with and being exposed to elephants, like, sort of everything changed. For example, my son, who's 9, knows I'm bonkers about elephants, has developed this ritual whereby every few weeks he asks me, you know, why do you love elephants so much? Even though I just fully explained that a few weeks ago, the last time he asked me. So that's important what my answer is, but I'd sort of like to redirect the question my kid always asks me and ask you, you know, what do you love about elephants so much? What's special about them?
This is the million-dollar question,
yeah.
And it's actually something we just posted on our website also, just putting it out to our supporters, you know, asking exactly the same thing, because elephants are just so dynamic, they're so involved, they're so just completely captivating and fascinating, and in order to try to put what it is about elephants in a few sentences is quite challenging.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people have difficulty doing that. I know I do. You know, you're, you know, 20-some-odd years later in my life with elephants, I honestly don't know how to fully articulate it.
Yeah. If you had to pick, like, a handful of traits, even though obviously, like any other animal or human, elephants are different from elephant to elephant, but there's probably some things that over your years you found, like, wow, even as different as this elephant is from this one, they share this kind of personality trait or this kind of just tendency as part of the elephant magic.
I think, you know, if to try to put that in a few words, I think just an acceptance and also a thorough comprehension of life. They just seem to have this sense of knowing, the sense of understanding of what's happening, what they need to do to endure, and also what they need to do to give back. That can be a give back to other elephants, or just sometimes it's just a look they give you that makes you realize that they fully know who you are and what you're thinking and everything that's going on in your world and theirs. I mean, they just have this sense of connectedness to the world around them that is, again, it's difficult for, I think, in our human society that is very superficial, if you will. They just seem to, I think for us, it's hard to grasp that comprehension of how connected and how deeply in tune they are to everything that's going on around them.
Although sometimes I think even if you haven't had an opportunity to spend as much time directly with elephants as you have, even if you buy them from a distance or even see some pictures, sometimes those eyes, I mean, talk about your classic sort of soulful, all-knowing eyes. Wow.
Absolutely. You know, it's something that a lot of people, when we post photos about their eyes, I mean, it's just something that is very captivating. You can read so much about their facial expressions, about the way they hold themselves. And that's a question that people have often asked us is, how do you know what's going on with them? And ultimately, we don't know. You know, we don't really have a clue what they're thinking or what they're doing. But there's, you know, just like you can read the expression in a loved one's face or your child's face or even your dog, you can see the same thing with elephants.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just a degree of expression in their eyes, in their face. And again, as you said, in particular their eyes, that just lets you see that they are, they're there. You know, they are completely with you 100%. You know, there's a old quote of the eyes are the windows to their souls. And it's so true. I mean, you can just see so much in the look of their eye and again, a sense of understanding and comprehension and true appreciation for what's around them.
For sure. So let me let folks know this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, my guest is Scott Blaze, who's worked with elephants for more than 20 years. He co-founded the Elephant Sanctuary in Tennessee and is now CEO of the Global Sanctuary for Elephants. If you'd like to ask Scott a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. So Scott, in sort of your initial response, you briefly touched on the elephant sanctuary and sort of, you know, what happened and even just the vast expansion of size and elephants. But maybe just for folks listening who just may not be that familiar with the elephant sanctuary, maybe you could just hit a little bit more on really what it is and what it does and I guess especially maybe the kind of elephants that have wound up there.
Certainly. You know, with the elephant sanctuary, we set out to just give elephants their life back. And that's a very broad statement, I understand. But it's trying to create a space where they can live with others of their own kind, where they can make their own choices of where they go, when they go there, where most of their diet comes from natural forage. Try to encourage natural behavior and natural social structure. And in doing this, you know, it's a challenge with captive elephants. You know, we're essentially putting a bunch of elephants that are completely unrelated together and saying, okay, here's your family now. And it's the same thing that happens in zoos where you put, you know, three or four elephants together. The difference with the sanctuary is now they have enough space where they can choose where they go. They can choose who they hang out with. When you're in a small space, you're kind of stuck. You're almost forced to be, you know, you're forced to be roommates, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. When it doesn't work, it can be catastrophic in a small environment. There's nowhere to flee to. In a large space, they have the opportunity to walk away and keep walking away. You know, maybe over, you know, we, like I said, we started off with 100 acres and realized that wasn't enough. And when I say it's not enough, I mean, it was enough to sustain the dietary needs, but it's not like, you know, another question we were often asked is, how many acres per elephant is it required to sustain them? And to sustain their diet, you know, we say, you know, maybe 10 or 20 acres per elephant. But when you talk about the social needs and the psychological needs, we don't have a number on that. You know, whether it be one elephant or 10 elephants, we realize that in many cases, 100 acres isn't enough. 200 acres isn't enough. And that's why we grew to and expanded onto 2,700 acres. Once the group of elephants that was allowed onto 2,200 acres of that, once we opened up that corridor for them, they thrived. They started wandering off, and we saw just another layer of growth and development with them that was just exponential. So as far as how much space an elephant requires, we really don't know. We know it's expensive. We know it's incredibly extensive. But again, the sanctuary is created to create a life where elephants can just be elephants.
Yeah. And maybe as a parallel point, Scott, maybe, again, for folks who may not be as steeped in the elephant world, maybe you could sort of just address in the wild how an elephant would spend, you know, his or her day typically in terms of space and roaming and eating and that kind of thing.
Certainly. Yeah, in the wild, I think if you look at the natural structure of elephants, it is a very strong family bond. Those family groupings can be anywhere from, you know, 5 to 10 and up to 200, depending on the seasons. Very extended families tend to group together during rainy seasons, and during dry seasons, they tend to spread out a little bit. But those intimate family groups tend to be all related individuals. It's mothers, sisters, aunts, grandmothers, young males. Once males start reaching puberty, they kind of go off on their own and maybe join a little bachelor group of males. And then for a lot of their life, they're more or less solitary, with one or two friends that they tend to hang out with, but spend a fair bit of time alone and intermingling with the herd infrequently. But they are occasionally intermixed with the herd. But the core group of the female society, the matriarchal society, it's all related individuals. So if a female elephant is born into the herd, they are there for their entire life. They form very, very strong, very close bonds. And it is their nature to try to do so. Again, in captivity, to try to recreate that, it's challenging. It's not really easy to do. But that's one of the goals that we want to try to do with giving elephant sanctuaries, create an opportunity where they can develop strong bonds, where they know they will be together for the rest of their lives, for no matter how long that will be. Because that is such an intimate part of it and such a fundamental part of the society. And basically they spend their days grazing. They eat for up to 20 hours out of the day, you know, foraging, swimming, playing. They're really just fascinating to watch in the wild. I was granted an opportunity a couple years ago and just, you know, I had already was already in love with elephants, but that just put it over the top. To see them in their natural space is just nothing short of extraordinary.
Sure. Before we move on kind of more to the Global Sanctuary for Elephants, my sense is that you kind of had eased out of day-to-day involvement with the Elephant Sanctuary a bit ago. Do you still have some involvement? Do you still serve as a consultant, Scott, there? Or what is your involvement at this point?
At this point, no. I served as a consultant for a little over a year after I left. So I'm no longer consulting with them. I am in communication with them on a periodic basis.
Okay.
But, you know, things seem to be going really well, and very happy for them. And, yeah, I did step out, I guess, fall of 2011.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically I had put 16 years of my life into the elephant sanctuary, starting it from the ground up. And, you know, I was 22 years old when I started it. So after many years of 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and, you know, during the evolution of the sanctuary, realized that I needed to step away just to make sure that I was on the right path.
Sure.
You know, really, that's all I had known in my life. And the last 2 years really solidified that for me. You know, I have a phenomenal opportunity where I live right now to really enjoy my life, but I have so much more that we can give. We have so much more that we can give back to elephants, and that's what we want to do. We want to, you know, completely commit ourselves. We are and know that's where I belong.
And where do you live now, Scott? Since...
I'm in a small town of Oriental, North Carolina.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Yeah, it's a great little space, you know, wonderful little retirement community, and oddly enough, I picked up a job making sails for sailboats and have phenomenally supportive employers who understand my dedication to elephants and just, you know, have been, you know, incredible for allowing me to move forward with this new venture and give me the time and space to do so. It's just, again, a great opportunity for me to get grounded and really just, again, solidify my future where I want to go. And that direction is undoubtedly with elephants.
Sure. Well, and in fact, we should thank them because I think they kind of allowed you to be able to speak with us at this very moment on today's show. So
exactly.
Very cool. So what sort of things then that you learned and maybe sort of grappled with during all those years at the Elephant Sanctuary and you know, beyond those experiences, do you see as critical to the path that's kind of led you to helping, you know, launch the Global Sanctuary for Elephants?
I think the biggest thing is when we were with the Elephant Sanctuary, we kept our minds open to the elephants. We wanted to see what their needs were. We went into it with this concept of 100 acres is enormous. We may let them all free and they're all going to become rogue and wild. And we saw exactly the opposite. One, we saw 100 acres isn't enormous to an elephant. And two, we saw once they had the space, once they had the freedom and autonomy, they became much more placid. They became much more cooperative. That doesn't mean there aren't struggles involved. You know, it can be very challenging. But generally speaking, elephants thrive once you give them that space. And so in opening up our life to elephants in that way and our minds to elephants, we learned a phenomenal amount. Most importantly is how much we discredit them and don't do them justice, not only with their spatial limitations, but also the psychological and emotional limitations that are that small spaces, how they constrain an elephant's life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think we underestimate, and we all, you know, everyone talks about how majestic and wonderful and emotionally sensitive and intelligent they are, but I think what we do to them in captivity is somewhat contradictory to everything we say about them. You know, once, you know, giving them more space just allows them to become these, just their full selves.
Yeah.
And I think until you have an opportunity to see that, you don't fully comprehend what that means. Recently I was involved, I was honored with the opportunity to help move 3 elephants from Toronto to Performing Animal Welfare Society, sanctuary in California, and talking to some of the caregivers, the old keepers. You know, everyone's concerned about how they will adjust. You know, this is all they've known in a small space. You know, will they adapt? Will they run away? Will they understand? And again, I think that undermines what we talk about with their intelligence and sensitivity. They thrive in those environments if you just allow them the opportunity. And that's one of the things we learned at the sanctuary from them. And that's one of the things I think one of the biggest gifts we can bring forward is just having that comprehension of how much more the life can be if you create that opportunity for them. And we want to be able to share that, not only with them, but also with people, so they can understand and develop a better appreciation for what elephants' needs are and again, who they truly are as individuals and as a society.
Well, you know, we might circle back, of course, pretty quickly to the Global Sanctuary for Elephants, but I was going to ask you later on in the conversation anyway about the Toronto Zoo elephant sort of issue, not knowing that you were directly involved. This is something we've talked a lot about on this show, not only because I, you know, have an admitted elephant obsession, but also I have family in Toronto who've been nice enough to kind of really keep us posted on the coverage there, because I think it's it's more than just the specifics of what happened there, although there were some things that were unique maybe to that situation. But, as you know probably better than most, I mean, it was a really complicated, emotionally charged, sort of controversial situation. For people listening who maybe haven't heard any of the various reports we've done on it, I mean, basically there was these three elephants at the Toronto Zoo, and their decision had been made to relocate them. That Toronto really wasn't the right place for elephants, not surprising perhaps. And there was an opportunity to move them to this great, other main sanctuary in the States, alongside the one that Scott helped launch, the Elephant Sanctuary. And this is the PAWS one in Northern California. But my God, it got delayed, and there was fights and city council battles, and Bob Barker was offering to pay to fly them and pay to drive them. So maybe you could just, because to me, it really speaks to how strongly people on both sides of the divide of captive elephants and the virtues or lack of virtues of elephants in zoos. Maybe you could just take a moment and sort of address that just from your own perspective and knowledge, obviously, of elephants.
Certainly. I mean, this is another one of those, as you said, very dynamic situations. But the key thing, I think you said, is emotionally charged. And I think that's where the basis of these arguments come from is, those that are on the side of pro-zoo are emotionally charged because they're really attached to their elephants. They don't want their elephants to leave. And part of that is a selfishness. And I understand that. I've completely been there. When I left the elephant sanctuary, it was very challenging for me to walk away from that. Not only from everything that we constructed, but also, the lives that and the relationships that we did form. But also on the other side, it's emotionally charged because most people that have seen sanctuaries and seen elephants thrive in sanctuary understand how much better their life can be if just granted that opportunity. So the emotional connection, and we already talked about it, people around the world are just fascinated with elephants for whatever that reason is, and that does bring out, a degree of emotion that sometimes overrides logic.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens on both sides. That's just not me pointing the finger. I mean, I'm guilty as charged on being emotionally charged and being very passionate about, pro-elephant scenarios.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean I'm always right with it, but it is, a very emotionally charged debate. I think the biggest thing that I saw, and I was on the outside of this, I wasn't asked to be involved until late in the process, and for those that were involved in the heat of the battle, it was pretty ugly.
Yeah.
There were a lot of very slanderous things that were thrown back and forth, and I understand, again, from both sides how that happened. But from my perspective, most of those arguments against moving them to the sanctuary were not based on fact. They're based on half-truths. They were based on myths. They were based on not fully comprehending what sanctuary is or the complexity of management that takes place in a sanctuary. A lot of people have said about the elephant sanctuary in Tennessee you can't just let elephants just run free and let them go and do what they want. And that's not how it is. We give them a life, but they're still managed. There's still barns. There's still training. There's still footwork that needs to be placed. There's still medical care that needs to be placed. It's still a managed operation.
Yeah.
It's just managed with substantially more freedoms and autonomy.
Well, yeah, because you've said a couple different times just in explaining about the elephant sanctuary, but just generally some of the importance of any sort of sanctuary and what's really ultimately important to an elephant who wound up being a captive elephant in one way or another, is the idea of space and the idea of choice, as opposed to what their life is like in a zoo and especially in a circus, and just how
exactly
much that helps them heal and have, like you say, come closer at least to living like elephants.
Right. And I think, the other thing that happens is people have we pigeonhole other people into categories. And I think the same thing happens with elephants. They kind of get labeled, and this is who they are, and this is how they are. And because that's in a zoo or a small environment, that's all they can be. But you take a person out of their small town or out of the city and put them in a small town, and that person is going to shift too.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to adapt. Some are going to thrive. Some are not. When looking at people moving back and forth, some are going to resonate with one life versus another. And the same thing happens with elephants. They will change drastically when they come to sanctuary. And we saw substantial changes. We saw, we had caregivers or keepers that came in, 6 months or a year or even 2 years after one or the other elephant arrived. And basically the caregivers would say, I wouldn't recognize that elephant. You know, we had one elephant that arrived. It was actually, her name was Sissy. She came from El Paso, Texas, and, moved to the sanctuary. She had a pretty brutal past. The reason why she arrived to the sanctuary is because of the training that took place with her. She wasn't doing well in the captive environment. When she arrived, our USDA inspector wrote an internal memo and said, I'm really concerned about this one. I don't think she's going to make it very long. A year later, he came back for his annual inspection, and he said, okay, I want to go see Sissy. I want to see how she's doing. And she was standing, 20 yards in front of him. He said, there's no way that can be the same elephant.
Wow.
We saw, and that's somebody that didn't know the personality, just looking at the physical confirmation and just the expression on her face had completely changed. But even, again, going back to zoos, zoo elephants and keepers that have followed up on them, they're just overwhelmed by the positive change that takes place.
Yeah.
And again, it's another thing that's difficult to articulate until you have an opportunity to see it and fully get a comprehension of it firsthand, because it's overwhelming.
Well, and it might sound a bit silly, but the USDA inspector story, kind of underscores this, that after some time in the sanctuary, especially, again, depending on what sort of captive environment they came from, like, their body language is different, right? Their body language, their body posture, right? The elephants, after a certain time in sanctuary and being able to live their life more like elephants and roam free and make some cool new friends, right?
Exactly. The changes that we see are profound. I mean, not only in the physical, the way they hold themselves, and again, without trying to go through the anthropomorphism, and comparing too much to humans, but when you just see a person that isn't feeling well, that isn't fully in their full capacity, they tend to be hunched over a little bit. They tend to be a little bit withdrawn when you look at their face.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a physical and emotional scenario. And the same thing happens with elephants. They just kind of hold themselves a little bit down, and they're, again, retracted within themselves to a certain degree. And once they're allowed that opportunity to come out of that, and it can take months, it can take years in some cases for that to happen, once they start coming out of that shell, they completely transform. I don't know how to convey it aside from, comparing back to what we see with people. It can be with people within a relationship. You see somebody that finds their life partner, and you see a presence about them that completely changes.
Yeah.
And that's the type of shift that happens with elephants. I mean, they just thrive when given the opportunity. And again, it can take years. Because of the emotional and physical damage that has taken place, it can take 2 or 3 years for that to happen. We had some elephants, Sissy being one of them, who we already talked about. It took her 4 weeks before she built up the courage to fully leave the barn and walk out into the pasture.
Wow.
It was very challenging for her because of how constrained her world had been. And now, my goodness, she's all over the place.
Yeah.
She spends 4 or 5 months away from the barn where you have to go out and search for her each day. To watch that transformation take place, it's just astounding. And it really changes your perception and your understanding of what elephants need.
And really, I can only assume that's exactly kind of one of the key things you're trying to cultivate with the Global Sanctuary for Elephants. So walk us through the organization's chief objectives and maybe how international sanctuary issues may differ from domestic sanctuary issues.
Certainly. This all evolved because we were contacted by Elephant Voices, Joseph Poole and Peter Granley, a very, very renowned organization and doing phenomenal work, because they were involved with some efforts in Brazil to help support proposed legislation to ban performing elephants.
Mm-hmm.
As part of that, they wanted to make sure there was a solution for those elephants also. If elephants are no longer allowed to perform, where do they go? What does their life become?
Okay.
In some cases, they're being tucked away in remote farms. Others are going to makeshift facilities in zoos to hold them temporarily. There aren't a lot of spaces in zoos, and the spaces that do exist in zoos in South America are quite limited. So part of their complete effort, their complete thinking on this was to research the possibility of developing an elephant sanctuary. That's when my wife Kat and I were pulled in, asking for our advice to see how we could move forward. We've worked on a couple different variations and weren't sure exactly how it was going to evolve. And what came up as we were developing as a nonprofit organization to develop support for this venture initially was just going to be Elephant Sanctuary Brazil. And we realized that we were selling ourselves short and selling the potential short. And that's why it evolved into Global Sanctuary for Elephants. We want to be able to provide pivotal support, you know, and that can be financial support, it can be labor, it can be advice, it can be, you know, directing the operations. It can be any number of things. We're not sure how that will evolve at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But pivotal support to help sanctuary efforts get off their feet. The first few years are always the most challenging. It's very difficult to get upfront funding for a project that may or may not develop. And we feel we can help that through. We can bring the knowledge, we can bring the experience, and we can bring the reputation to these developments or to these programs to help develop sanctuaries internationally. We have seen a couple of efforts that have kind of stagnated at the conceptual phase, and it's tragic because we really need sanctuaries. Elephants need a place to go, and we feel that we can be that pivotal building block that will help these efforts come to fruition.
And
how they're different. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead, Scott, sorry.
How that's different internationally versus domestically, you know, this is a work in progress.
Yeah.
The biggest thing we see in South America is they are substantially more progressed in their compassionate legislation. There are five countries in South America that have already passed bans on performing elephants.
Wow.
We have a couple of counties that have done that in the United States.
Yeah.
LA County has just passed a ban on bull hooks. That doesn't mean you can't use performing animals. It just means you're not allowed to use the arcane tool for that is typically used to dominate them. But so the progressive legislation that exists is substantially, you know, more advanced than what we're seeing in the United States. So as far as working in that culture, we're not sure exactly how that's going to evolve at this point. We are hoping that we can raise enough funds to take a trip to Brazil in November, spending 4 weeks there, exploring some properties, developing, furthering some of the relationships that have already been established, talking to politicians and government officials, and just kind of getting a better idea for what it's going to take to really get this off the ground. Everything's pointing in the right direction. Everything points like we have, it's just going to be substantial, positive, and can make a substantial difference. But again, there's still a lot to learn about working in foreign countries and international welfare.
Sure. Well, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Scott Blaze, the CEO of the newly created Global Sanctuary for Elephants. So we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing dj@wmnf.org. It's so interesting, Scott, because it seems like a lot of people who love and care about elephants, though obviously, you know, wouldn't have your degree of expertise, are discussing like the challenges facing elephants or some of the more serious plights. It doesn't seem that, at least in my experience, that South America, you know, comes up or is a prominent part of that conversation. But it's interesting that as you say, that the five countries have already, you know, banned performing elephants, that in some ways they sound well ahead of the curve. And is the idea of kind of when you guys went from saying, hey, let's not just focus on a sanctuary in Brazil, but more broadly, globally, think about this. Well, the idea sort of be not unlike here that where there may be another ban taking place, that the key thing would be to sort of in tandem with that make sure there's a facility for those elephants to go. And is that kind of the at least basic working model as you guys proceed?
Exactly. You know, we know that sanctuary works. You know, we based on, you know, performing in a welfare society and the elephant sanctuary,
yeah,
we know we have proof now that it can make a substantial difference. When we started the elephant sanctuary in Tennessee, you know, at that time, Paws only had a few acres for their elephants.
Yeah.
You know, they were the biggest facility around, and we wanted to go a little bit further with that, and consequently, they grew also. And, you know, we now have these two models to pull from, again, that prove the theory that this really does work. And what we believe is going to happen is once there is an organization that can help these concepts again come to fruition, we believe that there's going to be more requests coming in, and that's what drove us to develop something bigger than just Brazil.
Sure,
we want to be available in case there's a need. But as far as being ahead of the curve, I think it's pivotal. We're going to see a more progressive change. You know, we're going to see more legislation being passed. And we need to be ready for those elephants. We need to have facilities available Because otherwise, again, what's going to happen to them? Where are they going to go?
Yeah.
There just aren't enough options for them, not enough progressive options anyway.
Sure. Then you'd find yourself in that sort of be careful what you wish for scenario.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, well, we're just sort of in our final minutes. Let me first make a point of saying that for anyone listening who might be inspired to get involved, offer support of one kind or another, or just otherwise learn about the Global Sanctuary for Elephants, the website is sanctuaryforelephants.org. And, Scott, a few emails have come in along the way. We'll just kind of hit maybe a sampling here. One says, subject heading is great guest, big exclamation mark. I saw an amazing picture of Scott hugging an elephant on the Talking Animals Facebook page. Who was that elephant and where was it taken? Thank you for your work with these amazing creatures. I think this might have been the one with hugging Bunny, I want to say.
Actually, I saw two of them. I saw one with Jenny and one with Bunny, and I'm not sure which one they're referencing. You know, I'd have to go to your website, but it's either going to be Bunny if she's has a little bit of a chunky face. Sorry, Bunny. But if she has a little bit of a chunky face, that's Bunny. There's one that has more of the full body shot, and that's Jenny. And those are two elephants that came to the Elephant Sanctuary in Tennessee.
Right. Okay, cool. Because, yeah, I mean, the picture I know she's referring to, and I've had a few comments about it, like, it's sort of this very poignant shot, really, of between the elephant and you. Just there's obviously a real emotional connection. So I think a lot of people were sort of moved by that. And then here's the thing that sort of overlaps something I've been thinking and mentioned, but anyway, I'll just read it. It says, hi, Duncan. I recently saw the Blackfish documentary on CNN, and I was wondering, is there a similar documentary that exposes mistreatments of elephants? I was surprised by the Blackfish film and how being confined in a small area made Tilikum pretty psychotic. Do elephants suffer a similar psychosis from such confinement? So, Scott, do you want to at least take the second part of that?
Sure. You know, at this point, I don't know of a documentary that's taking place. I think it would be very beneficial to develop a better understanding of what actually happens to elephants in captivity. And I do believe there's a very similar scenario that happens, a very similar psychosis that develops. And you see it with some of the neurotic behavior that takes place. You see it with some of the elephants that are lashing out aggressively. Not only to people, but also to each other. I think there is a substantial difference, though, with whales. And again, not to belittle the plight of elephants by any stretch of the imagination, but even, I think, just with whales and dolphins, I think you take the degree of captivity to a completely different degree. I mean, you're putting them in a very confined space, and they would wander, you know, tens of thousands of miles as during their migration. And I think, again, it does cause substantially more problems for marine mammals. But again, I don't want to take away from elephants by saying that. But there is a similarity, and it absolutely breaks my heart to see what's happening with whales. And thrilled that somebody actually did a documentary that does expose more of the truth and the reality of behind the scenes what actually goes on with these animals.
Absolutely, and I'm going to touch on a little bit more in a little animal news segment in a few minutes, but Blackfish, I mean, to me, was such an important lesson because even when it was in the theaters, the impact it had on people, it was so profound and eye-opening, and then, of course, with these airings on CNN, it's just that's all been sort of exponential. And for a long time, I've wanted to see there was a way to get a documentary made on sort of, you know, circus elephants in particular. And, you know, a family friend is the guy that created Frontline. I've talked to him. And just even the other night, I saw seeing what happened with Blackfish, but it has to be a really skilled documentary maker. I mean, she came to this not having any agenda or activism. She was just a very experienced and gifted filmmaker. You know, look at the results. So I'm still hopeful that somehow there will be a counterpart on elephants like that. And people will get even, you know, more gigantically sort of powerfully informed just as a result comparable to Blackfish. So, Scott, we are just sort of at the end of our time, but one last quick question. Do you know much about this place in Fellsmere, the so-called sanctuary that is underway here in Florida?
You know, I only know what I've read. I haven't visited the facility and haven't talked to anybody directly about it. Only what I've read online and in news articles.
Yeah.
You know, again, I think it's a big step in the right direction, giving elephants more space. There are some things that I have a little bit of conflict with, and I think the biggest one is probably the lack of space. I mean, here's a huge opportunity. They have, you know, quite a bit of funding. You know, again, I think we're selling elephants short by, you know, only doing 25 acres, and I know they have, you know, 250 acres to expand onto. But I think, you know, I encourage them to look bigger. I think, you know, and when allowed the true opportunity to live in that and to be their full selves, it's profound what can happen. And I just encourage them to keep growing because and not sell the elephant short by limiting what you offer them.
I think there's a few questions that would be the most notable, but also I think they're breeding elephants and I think maybe trying to restock the zoos and stuff that they've come from. So yeah, it's a little murky at this point. I'm still trying to find out exactly what the story is. But Scott, thank you so much for joining us. We've been speaking with Scott Blaze, again, the newly launched organization. He's the CEO. It was the Global Sanctuary for Elephants. The website, again, is sanctuaryforelephants.org. There's also a great new Facebook page. Again, just facebook.com/globalsanctuaryforelephants. So, Scott, thanks again, and keep up the great work, and we'll get maybe a little progress report a little further down the road.
Wonderful. Thank you, Duncan. I appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely. Thank you, man.
Bye. Take care.
All right. In a few minutes, we'll speak with Gene Duby, the Sarasota Audubon, about their first ever Celery Fields Birdathon event for students coming up two Saturdays from now, November 9th. Right now, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. I wanted to do something elephant-oriented and brief, and this vintage piece from Bob and Ray seemed to fit the bill. This is Elephant Protest from Bob and Ray on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
Now, from approximately coast to coast, Bob Elliott and Ray Goulding present the Bob and Ray Public Radio Program. Well, welcome again. And we've got two important items on the agenda today. The first is in the nature of a public service announcement.
Well, it's a message from the elephant keepers at the Bronx Zoo here in New York, and we're happy to cooperate. It's been brought to the attention of these keepers that certain citizens have been exploiting their elephants.
Well, you know, these elephants are supported at the zoo for the edification of the taxpayers of New York City, as well as guests from out of town.
And the officials of the Zoological Society take a dim view of certain promotion-minded characters who've been painting advertising slogans on these elephants. For example, subscribe to the Cassily Memory Course and remember, like me.
Or let the Keene Express Company handle your trunks.
Now, these mercenary efforts are distasteful to all of us, and we ask your cooperation in helping stamp out the practice.
All right, that was Bob and Ray with a piece called Elephant Protest, taken from their album, The Best of Bob and Ray. Also, someone wrote in and mentioned the great elephant documentary, Apology to Elephants, which is wonderful. It aired on HBO, and you can find it, I think, on YouTube and elsewhere. So, yeah, it's close. Not really kind of the thing I have in mind specifically about circus elephants and ringling, and that would be a counterpart to Blackfish, but it is a wonderfully done film. So, anyway, she is the president of the Sarasota Audubon, here to tell us about their forthcoming Celery Fields Birdathon. Let's welcome Gene Duby to Talking Animals. Good morning, Gene.
Hey, good morning, Duncan. How are you?
Good. Thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals. Let's start, if we could, by just asking kind of for a brief overview of the Sarasota Audubon.
Well, we have 1,200 members here in Sarasota, and our mission is to protect birds and bird habitats, and we do that through education and through conservation.
Cool. So, and I gather, just given that the large number of members currently, that you're open to and sort of welcoming birders of all ages and experience, and sounds like kind of cultivating young birders along the way, which probably brings us to this cool event coming up on the 9th. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, it's a birdathon, which is it's an event that where people, either individually or in teams, in our case in teams, go out and count as many birds as they can see within a given period of time. And this birdathon is for students up to age 18. So we have a mixed bag of kids coming out there. We have three high school teams, and we have elementary school teams, and we have middle school teams. And we also have homeschooling teams as well. So it's going to be a fun event for them.
Great. So it's kind of like a neat little contest in a sense, right? To see which teams kind of spot the most birds that can people identify, right?
That's right. And each team will have an experienced Audubon birder who will lead them. And so, and we'll have binoculars to share for the kids, and it's a great way for the kids to get outside and to learn to appreciate nature, birds in particular, in our case, and to, you know, become aware of the environment.
Great. So, in a way, I guess by virtue of the name, we've sort of covered the where, but let's give people the exact details of the event. So it's Saturday, November 9th. I think it gets underway around 8:30 a.m., if I'm not mistaken.
8:30, that's right. We're going to muster the teams at 8:30 a.m., and it's at the Celery Fields in Sarasota, and that's on Palmer Boulevard, just east of I-75. And people can learn more about it on our website, which is www.sarasotaaudubon.org. And we're encouraging parents and kids to contact us to register ahead of time.
Right. So they'll find that out if they go to the website. But just as a little heads up that if they're interested in registering or getting involved, they can send an email to info@sarasotaaudubon.org, and that gets you kind of more involved from the get-go. So it sounds like it's a great event and a great way, again, to sort of cultivate new birders of all ages, and sound like a great day.
Oh, yes. We're really looking forward to it. I mean, it's such a joy to see a kid with binoculars taking a good look at a bird and then being able to identify it. It opens up a whole new world to them, and that's what we want to do.
That's fantastic. All right, so Jean, well, thank you so much. And again, it's Sarasota Audubon, and for some people who may get thrown by the Audubon, it's AUDUBON.org, and you can find out more about this great event and the other aspects of the organization. So thanks again for making the time, because I should mention quickly that you're actually right in the middle of a bird watching or a class kind of thing right now, and took a moment to speak with us right now, so I appreciate that.
Oh, you're very welcome. Come out and see us at the Celery Fields. You'll have a great time.
All right, Jean. Well, thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. All right, I'm Duncan Strauss. In another moment or two, we'll play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive a copy of Cat Sense, the new book by John Bradshaw, the anthrozoologist and cat expert who was our guest last week. We'll get to that in a moment or two here on Talking Animals. Right now, let's quickly hit a few animal news and announcement items. Kind of alluded to this in our talk with Scott, but the CNN airings of Blackfish have gone through the roof in terms of response, viewership, and so even though in theory the last kind of airing was going to be on Sunday night, and I posted a blurb on Facebook about it, and I got like 40 shares, and then they've subsequently, I guess, got even more response again, so they're airing at least one more encore broadcast this Saturday, 9 p.m. Eastern time. So if you haven't had a chance to catch Blackfish, catch it then, or DVR it then. And again, we interviewed filmmaker Gabriella Calperthwaite on Talking Animals on July 24th and had a really cool, interesting conversation. So yay for them. Also, something we touched on with Scott is that I want to be sure to mention is the Los Angeles City Council has sort of prepared to ban the use of bull hooks on circus elephants. There was an 11th-hour amendment where they've given circuses basically 3 years to either change how they handle elephants or remove them from shows. So it would have been nice if it was a little more immediate than that. But huge progress, because a city of that size to ban bull hooks is a gigantic step forward. So that's good news. And on a crazy animal news thing, you've probably heard about this, but the Dallas Safari Club, a Texas-based trophy hunting group, has announced plans to auction off a permit to hunt and kill a black rhino, critically endangered species. Organizers believe that the rare permit could fetch up to $500,000, which will be donated to fund future black rhino conservation efforts. And if you think, okay, that's preposterous or some kind of comedy thing or satire thing, indeed, a couple nights ago, Stephen Colbert did a nice long segment that you may want to check online. But anyway, pretty mind-blowing. So a couple of quick things also coming up locally here this Saturday and Sunday. The Animal Coalition of Tampa is doing their holiday pet and family photo days, and that's going to be at Lucky Dog just across the street from ACT. You can find out more by going to actampa.org. Also this weekend, again, is the Tampa Bay Walk for Animals. We spoke with Patricia Massari about that last show. But it's this Saturday, November 2nd, at Spa Beach Park in St. Petersburg. You can search Tampa Bay Walk for Animals or also Facebook. Ronnie L. will be there. Anthony Damiano will be speaking. Great thing. And I think that's all we're going to have time for. We'll get into other news and announcements and stuff next week. So I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. It's time to proceed to Name That Animal Tune. This is a giveaway. You do not need to be a WMNF member to win. There'll be a prize. Again, the copy of John Bradshaw's new book, Cat Sense. To the first person who calls in the correct title of this animal song, it's 813-239-9663. It's Name That Animal Tune. on Talking Animals. All right, we'll take any guesses that come in off the air. We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WNF Tampa. We'll be back next Wednesday with another edition. I hope you'll join us then. So visit our website, talkanimals.net, all our podcast information, Facebook page links, Twitter feed, and more. Just go, and we got it all there. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Happy Halloween to you and yours. We're closing out today's show with an animal song slash cultural phenomenon. People in my house have been hounding me, so to speak, to play this for weeks now, and I had other songs to play, other agendas to follow, and until now. So this is Ilvis with The Fox. What does the fox say on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Weeki Wachee, and beyond? Thanks for listening. Speak with you again next Wednesday at 9 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks.
Dog goes woof, cat goes meow, bird goes tweet, and mouse goes squeak. Cow goes moo, frog goes croak, and the elephant goes toot. Ducks say quack, and fish go blub, and the seal goes ow, ow, ow. But there's one sound that no one knows. What does the frog?